Welcome to Living the Good Life. Today is part two of the adventure and the science behind the mission of the boat company to save the Tongass National Forest in Alaska. There's a bit more science here, but it proves the value of saving the largest national temperate rainforest. Hope that you will agree with this.
Now, when Andrew and that guest were sitting quietly on that log, having that beautiful, peaceful human connection, they weren't just sitting on inert dirt.
No, they definitely were not.
They were physically sitting on top of an incredibly aggressive, highly active biological engine. And the crazy part is that this engine, located deep inside the forest, is powered almost entirely by the ocean.
Yeah, we so often compartmentalize nature. We treat fish as a purely oceanic resource, something completely separate from the terrestrial landscape. But in Southeast Alaska, the barrier between the ocean and the forest literally does not exist. The salmon are the physical architects of the forest itself.
The numbers in the wildlife fact sheet are staggering. I mean, I had to read this twice. The Tongass National Forest produces more wild salmon than all other national forests in the United States combined.
It is a biological powerhouse that drives the entire regional economy. The data from 2007 shows that commercial, sport, and subsistence salmon fishing, along with the associated hatchery operations, generated almost $1 billion.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, $986 million to be exact. And the salmon industry directly supports roughly 1 in 10 jobs in the local area.
1 in 10 jobs. That's massive.
And 75% of the commercial salmon catch in Southeast Alaska originates directly in the freshwater streams of the Tongass. The local biologists and fishermen literally refer to them as forest fish because the mechanics of how the forest grows the fish and how the fish subsequently grow the forest is an absolute marvel of evolutionary engineering. It is a perfectly calibrated system.
So the system centers on the anadromous life cycle of the Pacific salmon. We are talking about species like pink, coho, chinook, and sockeye. Pink salmon alone make up over 90% of the commercial harvest by volume in the region.
And I know anadromous is a fancy biology term, but the physical reality of what these fish do is miraculous.
It really is. They hatch as tiny, fragile fry in the shallow, freshwater streams deep inside the forest, miles away from the coast. As they mature, they undergo complex physiological changes that allow them to survive in saltwater, and they migrate out of the forest, down the rivers, and into the vast open ocean.
And once they reach the ocean, they spend years growing massive. They feed on rich marine nutrients, krill, smaller fish, squid, and gain immense body weight. Then, driven by an unavoidable biological imperative to spawn, they begin their journey back.
Which is the crazy part.
Right. Utilizing complex olfactory cues, essentially a sense of smell so refined and sensitive that human science still struggles to fully map it, they navigate hundreds or even thousands of miles from the open Pacific Ocean back to the exact same freshwater stream where they were born.
But here is the critical dependency. To spawn successfully, the fish absolutely depend on the massive old growth trees. If you remove the trees, the salmon die.
How so?
Well, the thick overarching canopy of the giant Sitka spruce and hemlock provides deep, constant shade. That shade acts as a natural refrigerator, keeping the stream water freezing cold, which is biologically required for the salmon eggs to survive and incubate. And the complex, sprawling root systems of those ancient trees lock the soil in place, preventing mud and silt from washing into the river and suffocating the eggs. And when a 500-year-old tree finally dies and crashes into the stream, the massive trunk doesn't block the river. It creates complex, swirling, calm pools of water behind the log.
Like little safe havens.
No. Exactly. Those pools protect the young, exhausted fry from the strong currents and from predators. The forest literally builds the nursery.
The forest provides the sanctuary, yes. But the biological debt incurred by the salmon is repaid to the forest in an incredibly violent fashion.
Right.
Over 50 different animal species in the Tongass depend on this massive influx of returning salmon to survive the winter. But the most critical players in this entire exchange, the apex engineers of the forest, are the bears, the brown and black bears that line the banks of these streams every summer.
Okay, here's where it gets really interesting. This is the chemical science that absolutely blew my mind when I read the source material.
Oh, the isotope stuff.
Yes. The fact sheet notes that scientists can hike deep into the woods, take core samples from the ancient trees in the Tongass, and when they analyze the cellular structure of the wood in a lab, they find marine nitrogen isotopes.
Which is wild.
These are specific, distinct chemical markers that can only originate in the deep ocean, in marine organisms. And scientists are finding heavy concentrations of these ocean isotopes inside the biological structure of trees located up to 500 yards away from the salmon streams.
500 yards. That is 5 football fields of dense, impenetrable, tangled brush and timber between the tree and the water. The ocean is literally inside the wood.
So how does a fish get 5 football fields into the woods?
Well, the mechanism is brilliant. A massive brown bear wades into the freezing stream and catches an ocean-fattened salmon. Now, bears are solitary, highly territorial creatures when it comes to high-value food. A bear does not want to stand on the exposed riverbank and fight off other aggressive bears, wolves, or eagles for its meal.
Right, that sounds exhausting.
So it grabs the heavy thrashing fish in its jaws and physically drags it deep into the dark woods for privacy.
The bear expends an enormous amount of caloric energy hauling a 10 or 20-pound carcass through thick brush. It finds a quiet, secluded spot under a massive tree, and because there is such an overwhelming abundance of fish during the peak run, the bear can afford to be incredibly picky.
It just eats the best parts, right?
Exactly. It eats the absolute richest, most calorie-dense parts of the salmon, the brain, the fatty skin, the nutrient-rich eggs, and it leaves the vast majority of the massive carcass rotting on the forest floor.
It just abandons it. It walks back to the river to get another one, and as that massive ocean-fed carcass decomposes on the moss, all of that rich marine nitrogen, all of those oceanic nutrients gathered over years in the Pacific, seep directly into the soil.
And the roots just soak it up.
Yep. The shallow, sprawling root systems of the ancient trees immediately suck up that nitrogen. The trees are essentially using the bears as an unpaid delivery service to import premium oceanic fertilizer directly to their roots.
It is a closed-loop nutrient transfer system of staggering scale and ruthless efficiency. Think about the cycle the forest builds, the cold, clear streams for the fish to hatch. The fish migrate to the ocean to gather thousands of tons of biomass. The bears physically haul those nutrients back to the trees. The trees consume the nitrogen, grow larger, and provide even more shade for the next generation of fish.
The trees are fundamentally constructed from ocean nutrients. It is a biological commodities market operating perfectly in the dark.
And those perfectly fertilized, rapidly expanding ancient trees scale up to create something even more critical for human survival. They create a globally significant climate vault. And this brings us to the invisible economy, the actual math of global carbon storage, and a dizzying, highly politicized federal tug of war over how this specific land should be managed.
And this is where we must be incredibly careful to outline the political reality impartially, relying strictly on the documentation and scientific reports provided in the sources. The administrative pendulum swinging over the Tongass for the past quarter century is intense, and the stakes are massive.
For sure. So what happened in 2001?
In 2001, the federal government established the Roadless Rule. This sweeping regulation essentially protected over 58 million acres of national forest land, including vast untouched tracts of the Tongass from new road building and commercial logging.
It basically locked the forest away from heavy industry. It said, leave it alone.
Right. But then official U.S. Forest Service notices detail how the Trump administration aggressively rolled back those specific protections in the Tongass to prioritize timber yields and mineral extraction. They effectively opened it back up for business.
And then subsequent notices in our sources detail how the Biden administration then repealed that rollback, moving to reinstate the roadless protections.
It is a constant whiplash-inducing back and forth of federal priorities. And I want to remind the listener that our goal here is not to take a political side or endorse a candidate, but to impartially report on the scientific counterarguments presented in the sources regarding these massive policy shifts.
Exactly. And the central piece of evidence pushing back against the logging policies is a highly detailed, peer-reviewed scientific report authored by Dr. Dominic Della Sala.
Yes, his report is very thorough.
Dr. Della Sala looks at the Tongass and fundamentally rejects the idea that it is merely a timber resource waiting to be harvested. He analyzes it as a multi-billion-dollar carbon vault. Through exhaustive field research, He calculates that the temperate rainforests in Alaska store an estimated 2.8 petagrams of carbon in their above-ground biomass and deep soils.
Yeah, I had to look up what a petagram is.
Oh, me too.
A petagram is a billion metric tons, 2.8 billion metric tons of carbon. If you try to visualize that physical weight, it is essentially taking the mass of every single human being alive on Earth, multiplying it by 3, and converting that mass into pure solid carbon.
That is insane.
That is what is locked inside the wood and dirt of the Tongass. It accounts for more than 8% of all the carbon stored in all contiguous United States forests combined. It is a planetary scale sponge.
And Dr. Della Sala takes that biological reality and applies conservative economic pricing to it, specifically to speak to policymakers in a language they understand money. If you price carbon at a very modest conservative $15 a ton on the global market, the economic value of the carbon placed directly at risk by the proposed logging alternatives in these unprotected areas is over $234 million.
And if you project that out over the century,
assuming global carbon markets mature and the protections are lifted entirely to allow full industrial access, the amount of carbon assets squandered would exceed $2.2 billion.
There is the $2.2 billion hidden under the moss. But to understand why logging threatens this vault so severely, we have to deeply deconstruct the government's official justification for opening the forest. During the rollback phase, the Forest Service produced a draft environmental impact statement, commonly referred to as a DIAS.
Okay, the DIAS.
And this document relies on some very specific methodologies to argue that logging the ancient Tongass is essentially fine or even beneficial for the global climate.
Beneficial. How do they argue that?
Well, the primary argument underpinning the DIAS is what Dr. Della Sala calls the wood product substitution myth. It assumes a zero-sum game regarding carbon. The industrial logic goes like this. If you cut down a massive ancient tree, the carbon inside it doesn't just vanish into the atmosphere to warm the planet. The tree is milled, and the carbon is securely locked into long-lived wood products, like the lumber framing a new subdivision of houses.
Okay, that sort of makes sense on the surface.
Right. And then you plant a new young tree in the clear cut. That young tree acts as a fast-growing carbon vacuum, rapidly pulling new carbon from the air, eventually offsetting any losses from the harvest.
So on paper, to a layman, that sounds perfectly reasonable. Cut an old tree, build a house, plant a new tree, net zero. My instinct is, shouldn't we cut old trees and plant new ones because new ones visibly grow faster? Like if I plant an oak sapling in my yard, it doubles in size in a few years. An old tree just seems to sit there.
And that was the prevailing theory in forestry for decades. The industry argued that old trees were essentially lazy or decadent, that they stopped growing efficiently and should be replaced by vigorous young saplings.
Decadent trees, wow.
Yeah. A young sapling might double its physical size in a few years, meaning its percentage growth rate is incredibly high. An old tree grows very slowly by percentage. But Dr. Della Sala aggressively deconstructs this myth, using what is known as S-curve science.
S-curve science, okay.
This science, based on analyzing over 670,000 trees globally, proves that the industrial logic is a fundamental confusion of percentage efficiency versus absolute volume.
Let me try an analogy to see if I grasp this. Think of a tree's leaf canopy as an array of solar panels capturing carbon from the air instead of sunlight.
I like that.
A young sapling has a tiny array of solar panels. It might be operating at 100% maximum efficiency, doubling its energy output quickly. But because it is so small, the absolute amount of carbon it can suck out of the air in a year is minuscule.
That is the perfect analogy. Now compare that sapling to a 500-year-old Sitka spruce. The old spruce has an exponentially massive surface area of needles, millions of them. It has a gargantuan thick trunk and a sprawling root system that covers immense ground.
Right.
Its percentage growth rate may be a fraction of a percent a year, but because the physical structure is so enormous, the absolute volume of carbon it pulls from the atmosphere every single year continues to accelerate. One single massive old tree does the heavy carbon-sucking work of an entire stand of younger trees.
Wow.
In fact, the S-curve research shows that the largest 1% of trees in these old-growth forests store roughly 50% of the total above-ground carbon.
The biggest 1% of trees hold half the weight of the forest. That completely destroys the idea that planting a field of young saplings can quickly replace the carbon work of an ancient forest. It would take centuries to break even. But the zero-sum myth also falls apart completely when you look at the physical reality of the timber waste, because the DIAS assumes the whole tree goes into a house. But what is the actual on-the-ground reality of industrial logging in the Tongass?
It is shockingly inefficient. Dr. De La Sala points out that up to 70% of the felled trees in these specific old-growth areas are classified by the industry as fall down or defect.
I want to stop right there. 70%. 7 out of 10 trees cut down are defects.
Yes. The majestic, perfectly straight logs you see on the back of a truck are the minority. The defect category includes massive, tangled root wads, twisted or bifurcated branches, the thin tops of the trees, and huge sections of the trunk that contain heart rot, insect damage, or structural defects.
Because in an ancient forest, trees are not uniform.
Right. Because these defective pieces are uneconomical to transport out of the remote wilderness to a mill, they are simply left on the forest floor to rot, or they are piled up and intentionally burned. All of that stored carbon immediately begins returning to the atmosphere. It never becomes a house.
So the vast majority of the physical tree never even leaves the forest.
Nope.
And of the 30% of the pristine wood that actually makes it onto a truck or a marine barge and reaches a commercial lumber mill, the math gets worse. Another 40% of that highly curated material becomes manufacturing, waste bark, sawdust, warped offcuts.
Which is a huge loss.
And in many rural mills, that waste is frequently just burned in incinerators to generate heat or power for the facility. When you look at the historical data of West Coast forests logged since the year 1900, comprehensive studies show that 81% of the carbon previously stored in those forests has already returned to the atmosphere or ended up decomposing in landfills.
Only a microscopic fraction remains stored in long-lived products. The carbon ledger is bleeding out.
Bleeding out, yeah.
And that leads us to an even more devastating flaw in the DEES methodology regarding how they calculate the vault. They are only calculating the carbon they can see above ground, the wood, the branches, the leaves. But the soil science shows that over 50% of the entire forest's carbon is actually locked deep below the surface in the complex ancient soils.
60%.
Yeah, and those soils are actively managed by what we call mycorrhizal networks.
We often hear this casually called the Wood Wide Web or the underground internet of the forest. But reading the sources, that analogy feels way too passive. It isn't just trees sending nice emails to each other about the weather. It is an ancient, ruthless, underground bartering system. It is an active commodities market operating beneath the dirt.
The biology is fascinating. The microscopic fungi in the soil physically fuse their cellular structure with the fine root systems of the massive trees. The fungi live completely in the dark. They cannot photosynthesize. Therefore, they desperately need sugar, which is essentially captured solar energy. The trees, with their massive canopies, have an abundance of sugar. Conversely, the microscopic fungal threads are incredibly efficient at mining the deep, rocky soil for phosphorus and other essential minerals that the massive trees need to grow but cannot access themselves.
So they trade. The fungi mine the phosphorus and literally sell it to the tree in exchange for sugar.
Exactly.
And the trees even use these massive fungal networks to share up to 40% of their fine root carbon with other trees in the stand, redistributing resources to keep the whole neighborhood healthy. If a tree is shaded out, a larger tree might pump nutrients through the fungi to keep it alive.
So when you clear-cut a forest, you aren't just removing the wood above ground. You are physically bankrupting and severing an ancient underground economy.
Which has to have massive consequences.
Oh, the consequences of severing that network are immediate and severe. The massive old-growth forest canopy acts as a physical air conditioner. It keeps the forest floor deep in shade, trapping moisture. Studies show the canopy can reduce local spring and summer air temperatures by as much as 2.5 degrees Celsius compared to adjacent logged areas.
That's a big difference.
If you clear-cut the trees, you suddenly expose those dense, carbon-heavy, damp soils to direct, intense sunlight. The soil overheats, it dries out, the delicate severed fungal networks collapse, and the entire underground economy dies.
And when that specific type of carbon-rich soil overheats and breaks down, it can begin to release methane gas. Methane is a greenhouse gas that is exponentially more potent than carbon dioxide in the short term for warming the planet.
Exactly.
So by logging, the forest goes from being a massive carbon vault to an active methane emitter. But the DEIS tries to claim that clear-cutting actually cools the earth. They use something called the albedo effect argument to justify the logging. How does cutting down a forest cool the planet?
Well, the albedo effect refers to surface reflection. It is basic physics. White surfaces reflect solar radiation back into space, while dark surfaces absorb it as heat.
Sure.
The DEIS argues that the dark green canopy of the conifer forest absorbs heat. Therefore, their logic states that if you cut down the trees, you expose the ground, which is lighter in color, reflects more sunlight back into space, and thereby cools the planet, offsetting the carbon loss.
Which sounds completely nonsensical if you've ever stood in a muddy, dark brown, clear cut in a rainforest.
Because it is a severe methodological error. Dr. De La Sala points out that the albedo argument does have scientific validity in boreal forests. The stunted forests much further north in the deep interior of Alaska and Canada, where the ground is covered in a bright white sheet of snow for most of the year.
Right. Snow is white and reflective.
If you clear-cut a boreal forest, you expose a massive, highly reflective mirror of white snow to the sun. But as Captain Jin told us regarding the weather, the Tongass is a coastal temperate rainforest. It receives massive amounts of rain, but relatively little persistent snow cover compared to the deep interior.
So it's just mud.
Applying a snow-based cooling model to a dark, rainy, muddy, temperate forest simply to balance a carbon ledger on paper is scientifically unjustifiable.
So the global mathematical reality is clear. The carbon vault must be protected to stabilize the climate. But we also have to pull focus and look at the local impact, the visceral reality, for the people who actually live there and have lived there for millennia.
Yes, the human element is crucial.
The sources extensively highlight the Tlingit and Haida Indian tribes. These communities rely on the Tongass not as some abstract theoretical carbon sink to offset emissions in New York, but as their traditional homeland and their literal physical pantry.
The reliance on the health of the ecosystem is absolute. The economic data shows that 90% of rural Southeast Alaska households depend on the annual salmon harvest. It provides nearly 30% of the total non-commercial wild food harvest for these remote communities.
Which is huge!
For many families, if the salmon don't return, they don't eat. Food security is directly and inextricably tied to the health of the freshwater streams.
But historical logging infrastructure actively threatens that food security every single day. And it comes down to something as seemingly mundane and boring as poorly designed dirt roads.
Dirt roads.
Yeah. The sources detail the existence of 182 problematic road stream crossings currently sitting in the Tongass. These are old, rusting metal culverts and small dirt bridges built decades ago by the timber industry to let heavy logging trucks cross the salmon streams to get to the trees.
Oh, I see. And the problem lies in the cheap engineering of those culverts, right?
Sorry.
A culvert is basically a large corrugated metal pipe laid in the stream bed. Over time, the stream washes away the dirt below the pipe. If a metal culvert becomes perched even 6 inches too high above the natural stream bed, or if the pipe narrows the water flow to the point where the current becomes a pressurized rapid funnel, a returning adult salmon physically cannot swim through it or jump into it.
And remember the anadromous cycle we discussed earlier? That specific salmon has navigated thousands of miles from the open ocean, survived predators and commercial nets, driven by an unavoidable biological imperative to return to the exact pebble where it was born to lay its eggs.
And it hits a rusting corrugated metal pipe it can't cross.
It just exhausts itself trying to jump into a pipe until it dies. By building a single bad logging road over a stream 50 years ago, you can block miles and miles of vital upstream spawning habitat. You stop the fish, which means you stop the bears, which means you starve the soil of nitrogen, which ultimately threatens the indigenous communities that rely on the harvest downstream.
That is heartbreaking.
The sources note that these bad culverts are currently blocking 64 miles of critical salmon habitat.
It is a devastating slow-motion cascade effect originating from a single point of forgotten industrial infrastructure. The damage radiates outward. Which brings us to a profound, almost uncomfortable, pragmatic reality regarding the very nature of conservation itself.
Yes, the diesel contradiction. And this is where the narrative loop closes and brings us right back to Hunter McIntosh and the boat company.
Full circle.
Because the scientific consensus tells us we absolutely must protect the forest. The survival of the global climate and the local indigenous communities depends on keeping the trees standing. Yet, to study the forest, to advocate for it, to remove those bad culverts, and to physically bring the wealthy donors and politicians to see it so they will protect it, organizations like the boat company rely entirely on heavy industry.
It is the defining ethical tension of the entire modern ecotourism industry. The interviewer in our sources poses this exact pointed question to Hunter McIntosh. She asks him, essentially, how do you internally justify running a nonprofit conservation organization dedicated to protecting a pristine, fragile ecosystem while simultaneously operating two large, heavy steel vessels that burn massive amounts of marine diesel fuel every single day?
It is a blunt, potentially hostile question. And what is so deeply refreshing about the audio is that Hunter doesn't dodge it for a second.
No, he really doesn't.
He doesn't offer a PR spin. He answers with absolute blunt pragmatism. He acknowledges the reality they run two big marine diesel engines. When the interviewer presses him about transitioning to hybrid engines or fully electric battery-driven vessels, he explains that the technology simply isn't viable right now for the extreme environment they operate in.
The physical reality of the Tongass is unforgiving. It takes an immense sustained amount of horsepower to push a heavy, watertight steel vessel through strong, unpredictable tidal currents, high winds, and deep, choppy fjords safely.
You can't just slap some batteries on it.
No, the energy density required to do that with current marine battery technology is just impossible for a ship of that size to carry. The batteries would weigh more than the ship.
He mentions that there's one small fishing vessel in Alaska that managed to convert to a diesel-electric hybrid system. But he immediately points out that achieving that required massive government subsidies and an entire winter sitting in a dry dock being completely re-engineered from the hull up just for one small boat.
That's incredibly expensive.
For a nonprofit like the boat company to attempt to install experimental hydrogen fuel cells or massive marine battery banks, it would cost millions upon millions of dollars, likely more than the ships themselves are even worth.
He openly admits the financial reality trying to force a technological leap that doesn't commercially exist yet would instantly bankrupt the organization. They would cease to exist. Their conservation mission would end entirely. So instead of paralyzing themselves, waiting for a perfect zero-emission technological savior, they operate aggressively within the flawed reality they have. This is their net gain philosophy.
They run brand new, highly efficient diesel engines and modern generators to minimize their footprint as much as physically possible given the constraints. And crucially, they rely on the output of their mission to offset the fuel they burn.
Right, the advocacy work.
By bringing those major donors into the forest, by funding local trail rehabilitation, by fighting the DB in court, and by advocating heavily in federal policy spaces to stop the clear-cutting, they ensure that the net conservation gain of their operation far outweighs the diesel exhaust of their engines.
It is a profound lesson in not letting the pursuit of absolute ideological purity prevent you from doing necessary, impactful work in a fossil fuel-dependent world. You have to use the flawed tools available to you to protect the asset.
I hear that, but I want to challenge this entire premise.
Oh, here we go. Devil's advocate.
Yes. Let's look at the macroeconomic argument against locking up the Tongass. If we accept Dr. De La Sala's math, and we use environmental lobbying to lock away 16 million acres of prime, incredibly valuable timber in the Tongass to protect the carbon vault, isn't that just a massive luxury of a wealthy nation?
How do you mean?
We live in a world that desperately needs physical resources. We need affordable housing. We need paper goods. We need lumber. If we declare the Tongass off limits, aren't we just offloading our logging and resource extraction to countries in the global south? Places like Brazil or Indonesia that might have zero environmental protections or labor laws. Aren't we just exporting our environmental damage to poorer countries so we can keep our beautiful mossy forest pristine?
That is a very common industrial counterargument. But if we connect this to the bigger global climatic picture, the scientific rebuttal relies on a concept called proforestation.
Proforestation.
Yeah. We are all familiar with reforestation, the act of planting tiny saplings after a clear cut. We know afforestation planting trees in a desert or a plain where there historically weren't any. Proforestation is the scientifically backed strategy that argues the most active, responsible, and globally beneficial management decision for a primary old-growth forest is to actively let it mature, to essentially do nothing.
Okay, I'm struggling with that phrasing. How is doing nothing an active management strategy?
Because it is a conscious choice to preserve an irreplaceable asset. The sheer unprecedented density of the Tongass, those 2.8 petagrams of carbon, the ancient mycorrhizal networks bartering below the soil, the nitrogen-infused dirt, is mathematically irreplaceable on a human timescale.
Right, it takes centuries to build that up.
You cannot replicate that immense carbon vault by harvesting timber from a younger, faster rotation prime plantation in the global south. The argument for proforestation is that certain ancient carbon vaults, like the Amazon and the Tongass, are simply too globally critical to open, regardless of the localized demand for lumber.
It's too important to touch.
The cost to the Earth's atmosphere of severing those fungal networks and releasing that trapped methane far outweighs any localized timber yield or housing benefit.
So we are not just lazily doing nothing. We are actively choosing to let the massive S-curve of those 500-year-old Sitka spruce trees continue to pull thousands of tons of carbon out of the air every single day.
Exactly.
We are actively choosing to let the vast canopy act as a massive air conditioner, cooling the local climate by 2.5 degrees Celsius and fighting global warming. We are actively choosing to let the bears drag the ocean nutrients inland to fertilize the soil. We are prioritizing a multi-billion-dollar global climate service over a heavily subsidized, inefficient timber harvest.
It demands a complete paradigm shift in how modern society views untouched land. It requires viewing a quiet, mossy, rainy forest not as a stagnant, wasted resource waiting to be harvested and turned into capital, but as a hyperactive climate facility operating at peak biological efficiency. The forest is working tirelessly for us, but only if we leave it alone.
When you step back and look at the incredible narrative thread we have woven today, it is just astounding. You have the descendants of a massive grocery monopoly using a boat previously owned by Standard Oil to advocate for the environment.
Such a wild origin story.
You have a guest with low vision experiencing profound, patient human compassion from a crew member named Andrew, sitting on a damp patch of moss. And that very moss is powered by nitrogen dragged out of the ocean by massive brown bears.
It's all connected.
And beneath that moss, microscopic fungal markets are bartering phosphorus for sugar to protect a $2.2 billion global carbon vault that is desperately trying to cool our warming planet.
It proves that our traditional kindergarten arithmetic for valuing nature, where a standing tree is worth $0 and a cut tree is worth profit, is profoundly, dangerously inadequate for the complex reality of the world we live in. The invisible economy, the one we cannot see, is the one keeping us alive.
For centuries, humanity has viewed untouched land as wasted potential. We are always looking for the immediate physical yield. We want the board feet of timber to build a house. We want to extract the minerals. We want to can the fish.
We're always taking from it.
But I want you to mull over this final thought. So what does this all mean? What if the greatest, most lucrative export the Tongass National Forest can offer the world isn't lumber? What if it isn't even the 40 million wild salmon?
Then what is it?
What if the absolute greatest export the Tongass offers humanity is simply time? Centuries of deep, undisturbed biological stability, acting as an irreplaceable anchor for our climate, silently buying humanity the precious time we so desperately need to figure out the rest of our problems.
It is a profound realization. The forest is giving us a window to adapt.
It certainly changes the way you look at a rainy day in the woods, doesn't it? Thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive.
Thanks for joining Living the Good Life. We will return next week. Hope to see you then.
A quick but important note. The information shared in this podcast is for general educational and entertainment purposes only. We love sharing our insights, but please remember, this content does not constitute medical, health, or professional advice.